Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
The Papal Visit, Religion and Politics in the Middle East. Hello again, I'm Owen Alney, and this is Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Pope Benedict XVI's Middle East pilgrimage has turned contentious. Does the religious leader have a political tin ear? We'll hear the assessments of Jews, Palestinians, and Roman Catholic Christians. Also on Which Way L.A., can a so-called Hispanic congressional district be won by an Asian candidate? Will the Obama administration and Congress decide that the state of California is too big to fail? First, here's the news. We're only back with Which Way LA on KCRW. Los Angeles teachers won't be allowed to stage a walkout on Friday. Judy Chu is giving Gil Cedillo a tough fight in a so-called Hispanic congressional district. And will the state of California go the way of Chrysler? Those stories at 7:30 tonight. First, this rebroadcast of today's To the Point. As Pope Benedict XVI continues his pilgrimage to the Middle East, different groups are pursuing different agendas. They include the Vatican, the Israeli government, and the Palestinian Authority, not to mention local Catholic and other Christian clergy, the chief rabbinate, and Islamic leaders. That's the way it's described by Anshel Pfeffer of the Israeli daily Haaretz. Good to have you on our program. Rather than describing all of those different agendas, tell us, if you will, how it's going with the Pope. He's had some criticism from Israelis. But...
Well, the Pope's visit, I think, can be best described so far, from at least from the Israeli perspective, as disappointing. You have to remember that the Pope, at least from an Israeli point of view, is not just the head of state. He represents a religion which, for close to 2,000 years, had... rather difficult relationship with the Jewish people. And when the Pope visits Israel, Israelis expect a more historical attitude from the Pope. I think that in the year 2000, when his predecessor, Pope John Paul II, came, I think he understood the correct tone, at least the tone that was expected from him, when he issued a formal apology to the Jewish people for the persecution that it suffered at the hands of Catholics over the generations. The current Pope, in his visit, especially in his speech yesterday at the Holocaust Memorial Yad Vashem, seemed to give a rather colourless, anodyne address. He mentioned very little personal regret or feeling of identification with the victims of the Holocaust, especially as this is a German Pope, and with himself a past during the Nazi era. So this was very disappointing for many Israelis.
What was he supposed to say, or was it a matter of tone rather than wording? He certainly did say he talked about the Holocaust and remembered
the
victims.
Obviously, he talked about the Holocaust, but. They expected a more personal tone. It was a very impersonal, very, one would say, almost a neutral tone. And, well, the Pope, for example, spoke of the victims of the Holocaust as people who had been killed, not murdered, which did grate on Israeli nerves. He spoke about millions instead of saying 6 million. And it seemed at one stage, at least, that he was equating those murdered in the Holocaust with unnamed people who are being persecuted in our times now. And for Israelis and for many Jews, it sounds as if he's equating the Holocaust perhaps with, I don't know, maybe with Palestinians or some other nation which is now suffering. And this is, I think anybody who's aware of Jewish sensibilities knows that this is the kind of thing that doesn't go down very well.
Two of the leading rabbis in Israel also told the Pope that he has a duty to spread the message that the Jewish people belong in the land of Israel. They said, your duty is to pass on the message that the Jewish people deserve a renaissance and a little respect to live in this land. In what way did he fail to meet their objectives?
Well, I think the Pope is walking an impossible balancing act. He has to, at the same time not to enrage the Muslim and the Palestinian elements here in the Middle East and in, you know, here in Palestine and in Israel, and at the same time not to offend too much the Israelis. So I think on that account, perhaps the rabbis that you just mentioned were expecting a bit too much. The whole visit has been described by the Vatican as a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, not a visit to Israel, so as not to offend the Muslims who obviously don't recognize Israel and think that this is Arab land and Israelis should probably leave. So I think the Pope, in that respect, is being very careful. And once again, I think the Israelis perhaps on that point had too high expectations from the Pope. Don't forget that the Vatican only formally recognized Israel in 1993, which was 45 years after Israel was founded. So they took their time on that. So the Pope, this is only the third visit of a Pope ever to the Holy Land, was being very, very careful and not to overstep any lines.
Anshel Pfeffer, again, correspondent for the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz. Richard McBrien is professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame, author of many books, including The Church, The Evolution of Catholicism, and Lives of the Popes. Good to have you on our program.
Nice to have to talk with you, Warren.
How do you respond to what Israelis are seeing as insufficient sorrow on the part of the Pope with regard to the Holocaust, not a personal enough evocation of the horrors that took place, and using the wrong terminology, killed instead of murdered, millions as opposed to 6 million?
Well, I think it isn't for a lack of sincerity on his part, but there is a certain measure of political tone deafness in this Pope. I think there are many good things about him personally. I think he's much more self-effacing, much less inclined to be at center stage than his predecessor was. But he also has some serious deficiencies, and they were brought out in his lack of foreknowledge, really, that there would be serious repercussions when he lifted the excommunications from those four Lefevrite bishops, one of whom is a Holocaust denier, and also when he gave that address in Regensburg in 2006 with the kind of the paragraph inserted, which was very offensive to many, many Muslims across the world. There's something about him that he misses these opportunities and he misses the signals. And I do agree that although I wasn't there and I did not read the whole text of his remarks at Yad Vashem, you know, it does seem that he missed a great opportunity, that he had to do more, especially as the first, not the first, but he's probably the sixth or seventh German pope, but he's certainly the first German pope since World War II. He had to say something of a more personal nature to reassure the Israelis, the Jewish community worldwide, that he did catch the sensitivity of the situation, and that he wanted to make it very clear that the Catholic Church's changed attitude towards its relations with the Jewish community, which were first brought about in, under Pope John the 23rd, then at the Second Vatican Council, that these new attitudes, these new perspectives, remain firmly in place, that nothing he has said or done, or anyone else has said and done in recent years, in any way compromises or diminishes the firmness of the Catholic Church's change, for the better, by the way, its change of attitude towards the Jewish community.
Let me ask you this. When he was Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, he wrote an autobiographical book, Salt of the Earth, in which he said he was automatically enrolled into the Hitler Youth when he was a young man. Today, his spokespeople in Jerusalem said the Pope was never in the Hitler Youth. Never, never, never.
No, I saw that. John Allen's column today, which is online. He's the senior correspondent of the National Catholic Reporter. I think it's a fairly honest and hard-hitting review of the Pope's missed opportunities at Yad Vashem. At the same time, he makes it very clear in his article that it isn't that the Pope, you know, doesn't have the right attitudes or the right views on these issues, because he cites in the online article, he cites a number of places where the Pope has expressed in very explicit terms the regret he had of over the Nazi persecution of the Jews and so forth. But for some reason, he didn't take advantage of it. I mean, John Allen points out that it's almost like the Pope figures that, well, he's already said that in other venues, and therefore he doesn't have to repeat himself, or that he always functions as the university professor, and he always has to speak in universal terms. It's not so much to diminish the peculiar suffering of the 6 million Jews during the Holocaust when he talks about the persecution and violence that afflicts so many in the human community. It's not that, but that he's speaking in these general universal categories. Well, that may be, that may be a plausible excuse from an academic point of view, but the Pope has to understand that he's not there as a university professor. He's there as the head of a billion member Catholic Church, which, you know, the previous interviewee said correctly, has had a very, very rocky, to say the least, relationship with the Jewish community. And he had to seize upon this opportunity to say and do more than he apparently did.
Once again, Richard McBrien is professor of theology at the University of Notre Dame. Let me go back to Anshel Pfeffer with Haaretz, the Israeli daily newspaper. What more in the way of public events does the Pope have? I know he celebrated Mass today in Jerusalem. How much longer is he going to be there?
Well, he's got a couple more days. Tomorrow he'll be traveling to the West Bank. He'll be visiting Bethlehem and one of the Palestinian refugee camps next to Bethlehem. And on Thursday, he will be traveling to the north of Israel, to Nazareth, and in each of these places, both Bethlehem and Nazareth, he'll be holding Mass. Obviously, all these visits have political ramifications, and for the Pope, possible pitfalls were if he steps out of line. Tomorrow, the Palestinians were planning to in the refugee camp to have the Pope speak from a stage which was built next to the separation fence, the fence that Israel built between Israel and the Palestinian territories. And the Palestinians obviously wanted the television cameras from around the world to film the Pope up by the fence, the Vatican, with Israeli some kind of Israeli influence here, were aware of this and informed the Palestinians that the Pope would not speak from that stage. And as far as I know, they've already made alternative preparations. Another important point about the visit tomorrow to Bethlehem: Bethlehem is seen by the world as being a Christian town, but in reality, the Christian population of Bethlehem perhaps is a quarter today. Many of the Christians of Bethlehem have left, and the Palestinians will try and highlight the suffering at the hands of the Israeli occupation. But one of the main reasons for the Christians of Bethlehem to leave and to emigrate to places like Canada and the United States is more direct persecution by radical Muslim neighbors. Now, this is something that the Pope will not point out tomorrow. Once again, he does not want to enrage Muslim sensibilities. He already did that in 2006 in his famous Regensburg address. So he's hoping that just by his presence there, he will somehow boost the confidence of the local Christian population. So that's tomorrow. Thursday, once again, he'll be visiting dwindling Catholic and Christian communities in the north of Israel. And the Catholic and the Christian community in Nazareth has also quite a lot of clashes over the last few years with the Muslim majority in that town. There's the famous case of the mosque that the Islamic movement tried to build opposite the Basilica of the Annunciation. The Pope's presence there will try to prove a point that Christians are there to stay. But obviously, the Pope and the Church are fighting what might seem to be a losing battle in this area.
To what extent is the Christian population reduced in the past few years? I understand now it's down in the neighborhood of 2%.
It's about 2% in the Israeli population. I'm not exactly sure what the number is amongst the Palestinian population, but it is also very low. I visited Bethlehem a few months ago, and you walk around the main square, around the main churches there, and you just talk to the Christian shop owners, and anybody who's under the age of 40 is basically telling you, well, we have plans to leave. We're just waiting for a visa. We're collecting money, and we'll be out of here.
Alex Awad is a Christian Palestinian. He is a United Methodist missionary in Jerusalem, and he's dean of students at the Bethlehem Bible College in Bethlehem on the West Bank. Alex Awad, welcome to our program.
Yes, thank you.
What are you and other Christian Palestinians hoping from this visit?
Well, first, I believe that most Christians in the Holy Land, whether they are Catholics or not, they will welcome the Pope, and they welcome the message that he is bringing, a message of peace and reconciliation. I believe he's extending a hand to the Jewish population, maybe not as much as they wish, and he is also extending a hand to the Islamic population, and perhaps not as much as they wish. But for the Christian population, it's a tremendous visit, because the Pope is highlighting the challenges that Christians have in the Holy Land. Today we have about 50,000 Christians in the West Bank and about 170,000 Christians in Israel. So the number of Christians are diminishing, and the church is dying out very, very rapidly. And this church needs somebody like the Pope to say, yes, we are with you. Not only the Catholic Church, but Christians around the world are standing in solidarity with the church in the Holy Land. So even though I am a Protestant, not a Catholic, but I, along with most Palestinian Christians, welcome the Pope's visit and welcome the message that he is bringing to this country.
When you talk about this diminishing population of Christians in the Holy Land, roughly what percentage is Protestant and what percentage is Roman Catholic? Can you tell us?
I'll put it this way. The biggest number of Christians in the Holy Land, I would say the largest number, is Greek Orthodox. And then come the Catholic Church with the Melkites and Maronites and so on, which belong to the same family. And then last, a very small percentage, about maybe 5% of all Christians, would you call Protestants, Evangelicals, and the new type of churches.
Do they have different agendas when it comes to the papal visit, or, as I think you said earlier, do they all feel a solidarity with one another because of the visit?
I think there is a spirit of solidarity. I mean, I'm thinking of our group at Bethlehem Bible College. I mean, we have big posters saying Bethlehem Bible College welcomes the Pope and so on. And not only us, but so many Christians who are not Catholic, and also even Palestinian Muslims, are going out into the streets of Bethlehem and later on into the streets of Nazareth, and welcoming the Pope and showing solidarity with his visit.
We heard earlier that when John Paul II visited in the year 2000 and made his famous apology and was so very personal in his approach and very dramatic, that he got a very different reaction from what Pope Benedict is receiving. Were you there at the time, and can you contrast the two?
Yes, I was there, and I think an apology is always good, whether we apologize to the Jewish people, whether we apologize to Muslims. We as Christians in our history, we did a lot of atrocities. And I think, you know, Jesus Christ teaches us to confess our sins, to apologize, and the Pope would be a model if he does that. So I agree with this, that this Pope should do that, or should do it more, perhaps. I mean, he's trying to open up, but not as much as the Jewish community and the Islamic community would want him to do so. But yet, I think, you know, all of us, instead of looking at the past, we need to look for the future. And we need to look for today. Today, the Palestinians are under a terrible occupation. Millions of Palestinians are still in refugee camps. There is a wall that is choking the Palestinian community. And Palestinian homes are being demolished. Palestinian land is being confiscated for the building of Jewish settlements. If the Pope wants to be true to himself, to his ethical beliefs, and to the teachings of Jesus Christ, then he would call a spade a spade. He will call the settlements evil. He will call the occupation of another people's land a disaster. And he will try to, tell the world community that this injustice in the Holy Land must end, so that the people of the Holy Land can live in peace.
All right. Alex Awad, Christian Palestinian Protestant in Bethlehem and Jerusalem. Mahdi Abdul Hadi is chair of the Palestinian Academic Society in Jerusalem. And thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us, if you will, we heard earlier that there was an effort to have the Pope appear in a place that would dramatize the wall, the fence that has been built between between Israel and the Palestinian territories. But if, I take it the Vatican has resisted that. Where is he going to appear, and what does this particular controversy mean for Palestinians of a Muslim faith?
Well, to make a long story very short, people are born original. But when you come to the Middle East, especially to Palestine and Israel, people want you to be a copy of their narratives, of their history, of their passion, of their feelings. And if not, you will find yourself walking on a landmine. And this is the case of the Pope and many other very distinguished and important visitors to the region. For example, when he went to the Jewish synagogue and Yad Vashem, the Jewish people expected him to weep, to cry, and to show more passionate about the loss of 6 million Jews, and not reminding the world of 55 million people killed in World War II. And when he goes to other places, like a Muslim site, people expected him to apologize for his narrative, historical background, in criticizing Islam and Prophet Muhammad. And now when he goes to the Christian community, he comes to speak about the historical deep-rooted bond between Jewish and Christian people without realizing that the Christian community here, loyalty does not go to Rome first, but to Palestine, to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem. And for them, some of them were shocking with this historical bond. This man comes to reflect his own narrative, his own history, his own understanding of things, and basically because he's a German, everybody expecting him to be very sensitive and very careful on every word, every statement, every signal he will give. Now, in his visit now to Palestine and Israel, we are facing the politicization of religion. I, as a Muslim, my faith is not completed if I don't believe in Christianity and Judaism as part of my faith, because Prophet Muhammad did not come to replace or to ignore, but to endorse and recognize. The conflict, Palestinian-Israeli conflict, is trying now in this particular phase to politicize religion. Therefore, anything related to the text, interpreting the text and practicing the text, has different narratives from Jews to Muslim to Christians. And this is the exactly problem of so many contradictions and so many criticism of the Pope visit today. When he comes to see the refugees, I expect him to show the passion and the feeling and the sympathy for my suffering for 60 years of my Nakba, my catastrophe under Israeli occupation. The same thing applies to the Israelis who want to see security and stability and recognition of exclusivity of the Jewish state or exclusivity of controlling Jerusalem. And we expect him, all of us, to speak in different language, that it should be open city, shared city, free access to the holy places, and recognize that the suffering and the pain cannot and should not be exclusive for one people and denying the other. The denial is there in the narrative, in the position of today in Palestine, Israel.
Let me ask you this. The Pope says that he is on a religious pilgrimage, just referred to the fact that all three of these religions come from the Abrahamic tradition. You say that you believe in them all. Does the Pope, because of who he is, have a chance to have a unifying influence, or are the politics just so powerful at this point with people wanting him, as you pointed out, to copy their narratives rather than his own, that's not possible?
Tolerance, acknowledgement, reconciliation, beautiful words, but the practice. Because today everybody is hijacking the agenda. The Pope did mention very clearly the Abrahamic faith. He did mention clearly the three faiths in the Notre Dame meeting yesterday in Jerusalem. But the receptive people, the people who are listening to him, expected a tone different, expected referring to the other side different. Where he comes from, a totally different school of thought. This is the man who knows what he knows, and he reflects what he understood, and he has no guidance in his tour. His visit today, people will look at it historical, religious, but I come to see it completely different. It's not only religious and historical. It's purely politics. Because this is the people's belief of today, their interests, their needs, and their aspiration, how to be free, how to be independent, and how to be recognized, to accept the other. Now, accepting the other, you need a ruler, you need a law, you need a system, you need a code, which is not agreed by everybody. Look at the United Nations resolution. Look at the Charter of the United Nations. Everybody has his own interpretation, his own implementation by the power it governs that phase at that period. Exactly here, everybody expecting him to be not only the copy, but to reflect what they believe in. And if not, he is criticized. And that's why he needed guidance. And that's why the window or the door or the venue for all of this is dialogue with honesty and openness without fear and acknowledgement of the other.
All right. I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Mati Abdul-Hadi, the chair of the Palestinian Academic Society in Jerusalem, Alex Awad with the United Methodist Missionary in Jerusalem and the Bethlehem Bible College in Bethlehem, Richard McBrien, a professor of theology, University of Notre Dame. His books include The Lives of the Popes, and Anshel Pfeffer, correspondent for the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz. Good to have all of you with us. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. In a moment, a judge says no to Los Angeles teachers. Racial and ethnic lines are being tested in a congressional primary on L.A.'s East Side. On Reporter's Notebook, state officials are in Washington looking for bailout money. All that on Which Way L.A. Warman Ali back with Which Way L.A. The United Teachers of Los Angeles planned a one-day work stoppage this coming Friday. The idea was to protest layoffs and class size reductions. The superintendent, Ramon Cortinas, called it dangerous, illegal, and irresponsible. Today, a local judge issued a restraining order. Connie Llanos is covering education for the Daily News. And Connie, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Did the judge agree with the superintendent?
You know, the judge did issue his ruling saying that he did it on out of concern for the safety of the kids at the schools. So whether I don't believe he went as far as calling the action illegal, although PERB has said has also issued a complaint against UTLA based on this proposed one-day strike. But I do think he shared the superintendent's opinion that it would not be safe for children if the teachers left for a full day.
What did the teachers say in response to that?
Well, you know, UTLA union officials are still talking with their legal team and their lawyers to figure out what this means and what next steps they can take. I haven't been able to get a hold of UTLA President Duffy. He's expected to show up at the LUSD board meeting later today. But a lot of union members are here, and they're obviously not happy about this action, but they do feel that they're going to recover quickly and figure out a plan B, relatively quickly.
Now, I said at the outset they were protesting class layoffs and class size reductions, and I know that is one of the things or two of the things they're concerned about. That they're also concerned, as I understand it, about the way federal stimulus money is being spent.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's been a big push from not just UTLA, but all the employee unions at the district. They want the district to opt to use as much of the stimulus funding as possible for the year 2009-10, so this coming school year, and in an effort to sort of stave off the largest number of layoffs. But the district is concerned about the future budgets, you know, not just this coming year, but the year after and the years after that. And they are within their legal rights to use it, to spread it over 2 years, and that's what they want to do. Although Superintendent Cortinez has said he's open to using more, front-loading more of that money this coming year if unions give him some solid concessions, and, you know, those negotiations haven't come to any solid agreements yet.
Does it appear to you that the union anticipated this ruling, that this was something they might not get away with, and that they really were, just trying to state this protest in as strong a terms as they could?
You know, it's hard to say. I did have a conversation with Duffy before this ruling came through, and he seemed very confident that the strike was going to happen, that tens of thousands of people were going to join him, not just teachers, but parents and students. So that would lead me to believe that he was confident that they were going to be able to move forward with the strike. Whether or not there was some expectation of this going down the way that it did, it'd be hard for me to say.
Sure. A.J. Duffy, of course, the president of the UTLA, the United Teachers of Los Angeles. They did authorize the strike, but as I understand it, more people didn't vote than voted as far as the teachers were concerned.
That is true, and that's also, you know, that's been an issue for the union, because there are some teachers who have even been outspoken about saying that they weren't exactly thrilled with a one-day strike, and, you know, some people anonymously, of course, have told me that they felt that it was in essence a furlough that they were giving the district, except it wasn't leading to any sort of positive agreement with the district. So. And, you know, as a matter of fact, we have a gentleman who from Verdugo Hills High, a high school in the Valley, who came up with a plan where he wanted to stage a walk-in and donate the money that he would have earned that day to his school to buy back positions.
So you get a sense then of just how desperate the financial situation is for the schools. And, of course, they're going to be moving a lot of people around. The teachers have said that there's a safety issue there. Have they not also with the reduction in the number of teachers that are going to be on the campuses?
Yeah, I think safety, just overall the campus environment, people are really concerned. There's a lot of anxiety out there. There's a lot of uncertainty still. I think people are still hoping that, you know, more of these layoff notices will be rescinded, and therefore there's a lot of hope, but then there's also a lot of anxiety because if things don't work out, you know, all these people are going to be losing their jobs.
Was there any kind of parental organization against the strike? That would be pretty inconvenient for parents who would have to hire daycare and do other kinds of things to take care of their kids.
Well, I know some parents who, did tell me that they were planning to fill in for the teachers. They were going to volunteer to make sure that their kids were safe. Over the weekend, I did write a story about parent organizations who are actually in support of the teachers and who were, some of them are even staging or planning to stage their own protests Friday. I don't know how this restraining order will affect those efforts, but that I know of no organized effort, but I'm sure there were a lot of working parents who would have really struggled to find care for their children.
All right, Connie Yanos, downtown, obviously, a lot of teachers in the background there. It's good to talk with you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Warren.
Connie Yanos, reporting on education for the Daily News. I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. When Hilda Solis became President Obama's Secretary of Labor, she gave up the 32nd Congressional District in Los Angeles and its eastern suburbs. 12 candidates are in next Tuesday's primary race, and the real battle is for the Democratic nomination. Jean Merle is reporter and editor for the Los Angeles Times, covering regional politics. And Jean, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for inviting me.
12 candidates is an awful lot, but it always boils down to two or three. Who are they this time?
This time, there's State Senator Gil Cedillo and Board of Equalization member Judy Chu, also a former member of the California Assembly.
And a third candidate has come up. According to your article, Emmanuel Pleitez, who appears to be making a bid.
Yes, he's raised a substantial amount of campaign contributions. He has a young, very eager staff of volunteers, a dedicated and experienced campaign consultant, and he's making a good run for it.
Now, this is a district that was originally drawn to be a Hispanic district.
That's right, and it has been since it was drawn.
And Hilda Solis obviously is Hispanic, so is Gil Cedillo, and yet
yes.
Judy Chu is giving him a run for his money.
Yes, she is. She has raised more money than he has. She's put on quite an extensive campaign, very energetic campaign that's for the most part been positive, although she did hit him with a mailer early on that basically reprinted an LA Times article by my colleague Michael Finnegan, pointing out how he had spent some of his political campaign donations. The Asian voters are definitely making a name for themselves in this district. They increasingly have some influence. Whether it's enough to put her in office right now is an open question.
Jean Merle with the Los Angeles Times. That district is 62% Hispanic, according to the latest census, 18% Asian, 15% white.
Yes.
Rafe Sonnenschein is with us. He's a political science professor at Cal State Fullerton, author of a number of books, including most recently The City at Stake, Secession, Reform, and the Battle for Los Angeles, moving from city politics to congressional politics here. Professor, good to have you on our program again.
Good to be with you.
In this case, some of the Hispanics who are very well known in that area, including the mayor of Los Angeles, have endorsed Judy Chu.
Well, this is one reason she has an excellent chance. I have no idea who's going to win, but she has a real shot at what we would call a crossover victory, which is to hold her own group and make significant inroads. Don't forget there's also a number of white voters there. You mentioned 15% of the population,
yeah.
Maybe more of the registered voters. And given that the Cedillo campaign is based at least in part on kind of ethnic mobilization, that will actually make it more difficult for him to win votes outside the Latino community. So she has a better chance and a greater need of being a crossover candidate than he does. But she's also got the local edge, which is the Latino community is pretty complex now, and there's a lot of local elected Latino officials who know her and are supporting her, whereas more of the state politics of the Latino movement is with Cedillo.
Now, the mayor, Villaraigosa, has endorsed Judy Chu, even though he at one time was very close to Gil Cedillo.
Well, they haven't been close for a long time, and in the last two mayoral races, they were not on the same side, and that was evidence of a pretty deep rift, since Villaraigosa was one of the candidates for mayor. They used to be pretty much best friends, but that's long gone. And also, county labor, the big labor federation, is with her. And the labor federation is, in some ways, the core of the local Latino political movement, is how it got linked up to labor. And the fact that she has that labor movement, Villaraigosa, and local resources, and many more people in this district have voted for her for office than have voted for Gil Cedillo for office. Had it been a Latino candidate more located in the area, say Gloria Romero, I think it would have been much, much harder for Judy Chu to be competitive. I think she's seriously competitive as a crossover candidate.
Back on the question of Latinos and who they endorse, another prominent Latino who has gone for Judy Chu is Loretta Sanchez, one of the two Sanchez sisters who are in Congress from Orange County. Her sister, however, has endorsed Gil Cedillo.
Yeah, well, it's a family dispute in a lot of ways, and in a larger sense, a family of politics. The other question is who Hilda Solis, the incumbent, very popular member of Congress, is, and she is not making an endorsement, but many of her family and associates seem to be leaning in the Judy Chu camp, which again is an argument that if you're going to be a crossover candidate, you have to be better known so that it overcomes what you might call the ethnic cue that helps people decide who to vote for. And we've seen cases of that in Southern California in the past.
Rafe Sonnenschein at Cal State Fullerton. Back to Jean Merle with the Los Angeles Times. Rafe Sonnenschein mentioned the LA County Federation of Labor, deeply involved in Latino politics, has endorsed Judy Chu. But what about the rank-and-file members?
Well, we're hearing mainly from the Cedillo campaign, of course, that the rank-and-file is not terribly enthused about their leaders' choices. But she's got the endorsement, and that's what counts.
Hard to keep the rank and file sometimes, though, when you have a very familiar name and an ethnic identity as well.
Yes, and it's unclear just how much the Labor Federation is doing in terms of being able to marshal volunteers.
You said that Judy Chu had gotten out one hit piece against Gil Cedillo.
Yes.
What's his campaign been like?
He's doing a lot of hit pieces, not only against Judy Chu, but he also put one out against Pleitez, which many people see as a sure sign that he's worried about him. Cedillo has he's hit her saying she gave tax breaks to her campaign contributors when actually these were routine refunds that the of overpayment of taxes that the Board of Equalization staff vets and recommends. And then he said she missed a vote on an insurance company tax dispute, and her campaign has said this is the only day of voting that she's missed since she's been on the board, and that the vote, she was delayed because the airline delayed the flight, and she asked to have the vote held until she could get there, and that the Republicans on the Board of Equalization refused to do that, just went ahead and made the vote. So that's why she missed the vote.
Rafe Sonnenschein, you said that more people there had voted for Judy Chu than had voted for Gil Cedillo. Is that because she holds such an office with a much bigger jurisdiction? The Board of Equalization has a very large geographical area. There are only five of them statewide.
Well, there's that, but there's also the fact that she represents the Assembly. She's had also local office in Monterey Park. So people are familiar with her. And because there's so many incorporated cities in this area, she's gotten to know a lot of the local elected officials. So in addition to people having seen her name on a ballot, she's been in meetings with a lot of these local folks who are, while they may be of a different ethnic group from her, consider her sort of a practical partner with them. And that's, in the local level, that can really make a big difference.
Jean Merle, what kind of money are we talking about when you say she has more than Gil Cedillo does?
Well, as of today, she had raised nearly $1 million, according to the reports filed with the Federal Election Commission. She had raised $992,000. He's not far behind. He has raised $717,000.
And Rafe Sonnenschein, is that a lot for a congressional race?
Actually, I think it's kind of cheap. I mean, when a congressional seat opens up, this is a gigantic thing. Remember, there's no term limits. So unlike state offices, this is the big thing. When a congressional seat opens up, it is like the greatest thing you can go for. So people would spend even more. I mean, it's well worth it. And once you get elected, you probably won't ever have to spend this money on your seat again.
You mentioned State Senator Gloria Romero as a potential candidate. Why didn't she run?
Well, who knows? I think she would have had a very good chance, but at the same time, she decided to make a run for state office. So she's going to be on the looking for a statewide office, and this was not something she wanted to do. I don't know more about how she might have assessed the race, but I think she would have been a very strong candidate.
Jean Merle, you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. She's now going, I think, for state superintendent of public instruction.
Okay. Emmanuel Pleitez, once again, or Pleitez, excuse me, you said Cedillo appears to be worried about him. Obviously, he could divide the Latino vote if, in fact, he did well. Is it sort of assumed, though, Jean Merle, that what he's really doing is preparing for the next office that might open up?
Well, that's what a lot of people, a lot of election watchers are saying. He and his campaign staff are saying absolutely not, that they believe they have a shot at this. They think we're all going to be surprised on election night, and that he's not interested in another race.
Okay, so Rafe Sonnenschein, if nobody wins outright on Tuesday, they're all on the same ballot, then it becomes a party runoff between the top Republican and top Democrat. I take it at this point everybody is saying forget the Republicans, they can't do it.
Yeah, I think it's beyond unlikely. I hate to say it, but I think the Republican candidate has no chance. The overwhelming edge of the Democratic vote in that district ensures that whoever wins the Democratic primary is going to win that seat.
All right. Fascinating election with that crossover possibility that we talked about earlier. Thank you both for being with us. Rafe Sonnenschein at Cal State Fullerton, Jean Merle with the L.A. Times. Good to have you both.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
It was a pleasure.
I'll be right back with Which Way L.A.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. On Thursday, Governor Schwarzenegger will issue two revised budget proposals, one based on the passages of Measures 1A through E in next week's election, and one based on their failure. In the meantime, the state treasurer and assembly speaker have gone to Washington in search of bailout money. Joe Matthews is Irvine scholar at the New America Foundation. And Joe, good to have you back on our program.
Great to be with you, Warren.
He wants all of these measures passed, but as for the current budget situation, only Measures 1C, 1D, and 1E would actually have an effect on it. Isn't that right?
That's correct. 1A and 1B have a profound budget effect, approximately $16 billion of tax extensions in 1A and $9 billion of education spending in 1B, but those all take effect in 2 years.
Now, 1C would take lottery money and reorganize it and give the state roughly $5 billion. The other two, D and E, would take money from voter-approved measures on mental health and childhood education, early childhood education, and they're a total of about $1 billion out of those.
Actually, all told, there would be about $6 billion, right, a little less than $6 billion up front this year, but again, those are temporary. Those are temporary takes from early childhood and mental health, so it doesn't fix our long-term structural problem. And the lottery is money up front. We're getting money up front by essentially selling future lottery revenues. The irony of doing two May revisions is that since 1C is so far behind in the polls, it has no chance of passing, and that's $5 billion of the $6 billion difference. There may not be actually that much difference between the two revisions, and really there isn't. We're in deep trouble whether these things pass or whether they don't pass.
Now, then the question becomes, is California, in the view of the federal government, including the president and Congress, too big to fail?
I think the answer is probably yes, we're going to be in deep trouble. Probably these things lose, and we're in deep trouble whether they win or lose. And we have a budget problem, but we have a related problem, which is a cash flow problem. And we always have good cash months and bad cash months in California. You know, tax revenues tend to come in early in the year, but we have to spend money throughout the year. So we're always doing short-term borrowing in the second half of the year to fund things. The trouble is we've had such a bad budget for so long that all of the usual sort of moving funds between different pots in the state accounts, we really don't have that option anymore. We don't have much cash around. And to do short-term borrowing in the markets, which we often do and have done in the past, is now very expensive because our credit rating is so poor. And also because we need to do so much short-term borrowing. We're so cash short. So we're talking about, you know, $10 billion or more short-term borrowing we need just to have the cash to run the government. So the only way probably to do that borrowing is to get the federal government to issue loan guarantees for the state to guarantee that short-term debt. And I think that that Congress and President Obama are likely to and would be right to make several demands of us as a condition of those loan guarantees. And I think those demands are likely to include and probably should include taking away some of our own, that is voters and elected officials, our own control over our own finances. I don't know whether that's a sort of a receivership or some sort of board like the one that's overseen the car companies. This is still fairly new. But I think we're likely to lose a little bit of our sovereignty as a result of our persistent, not just budget problems, but our very deep cash flow problems.
Going the way of Chrysler, perhaps General Motors, when you say, first of all, how much money do you think is involved? How much might the federal government come up with in loan guarantees? And then when you say take away our control, what do you mean?
I mean that they're going to give us money. They're going to guarantee our borrowing, let us borrow to keep things up, and they may demand.
So $6 billion or $12 billion?
It depends how much cash we end up needing to cover, our expenses. And that could be the LAO had a report on the cash flow. The legislative analyst in Sacramento, the nonpartisan office that advises the legislature, and said this could be about $20 billion, urged the legislature to at least get it down to $10 billion. And I think there, it's somewhat uncharted territory, but I think folks in Sacramento are starting to look at examples like the New York City sort of near bankruptcy of the 1970s, where there was sort of there were boards and there was federal oversight. I'd like to see a real aggressive move by the federal government to demand that we deal with some of our governing problems, you know, that make it so hard for our legislator to act and govern. I think it might mean new restrictions on the initiative process, perhaps even demands that we change the two-thirds vote to pass a budget, which has been such a persistent problem to us addressing our own problems in a timely manner.
And could the federal government actually do that? Could they force a state to take that kind of change?
I think politically it would be very difficult, and we would certainly there would certainly be pushback against it. But at the same time, President Obama might be in a very strong position to do something like that. You know, he got 61% of the vote here. He's by far, by many measures, more popular than any state official here.
State legislature, 14% or something like that.
And I think there is a certain aspect to this that if we do not get our situation under control, both our cash situation, our budget situation, and our governing system under control, we're going to continue to have these problems, continue to be at the brink until the economy comes back in a big way, and who knows what that will be. And that it might be, while it might be politically difficult, it would be wiser to deal with the situation and make big, hard changes sooner rather than later. Or else we may be having to go back to the federal government again in the future.
Well, from the federal government standpoint, too, you could always argue that California is so big and so important to the rest of the country economically that you better fix it up.
And I think particularly in the bond markets, there's some fear that if California starts to get into deep trouble, it could really undermine markets for credit markets for other states and municipalities. Already, municipalities are in a lot of trouble. There's problems in the market that insures municipal bonds. Municipalities can't get bond insurance. And so it's a really difficult situation. The Obama administration is trying to make moves to help municipalities across the country be able to sell their bonds. So this might sort of fit into that department in terms of from the federal government's perspective.
All right. So is there a receivership or a form of bankruptcy in California's future? We have yet to find that out, but here's the possibility from Joe Matthews, again, Irvine Scholar for the New America Foundation, also former reporter for the Los Angeles Times and author of The People's Machine, Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Rise of Blockbuster Democracy. Joe Matthews, good to have you back on our program.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Which Way LA, produced tonight by Gary Scott and Christian Bordahl, our managing producer, Carolyn Radziner, technical director, Mike Newport. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.